From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm producer Elaine Clark. The act of forgiveness has taken on new dimensions in the last decade. In the wake of school shootings, terrorist attacks, and other violence around the world, the concept seems very real as people cope with conflicting feelings of rage and compassion. For many, forgiveness is a religious notion, but another angle has been emerging. If doing it because God commands it doesn't work for you, how about because it's physically good for you to forgive? Studies have revealed that people who forgive live longer and have healthier and happier lives. Today on the program, Dr. Fred Luskin is our guest. He's co-founder of Stanford University's Forgiveness Project. He's in Utah, so we're rebroadcasting our conversation with him about the human effects of something so divine. Forgiveness today, after the news.
This week in Video West, stories from the tattoo convention in Salt Lake City last weekend. Among the people you'll meet is Utah native Shanghai Kate, kind of a pioneer for women tattoo artists. In the early 70s, women weren't even supposed to get certain tattoos, and some parts of the body were off limits to the ladies. They told Kate the business wasn't for her. And I guess you can imagine how that went over. Go see her and others at videowest.org.
This is Radio West. I'm producer Elaine Clark. While human behavior tends to be incredibly complex, we've gotten better at explaining why we react the way we do and what effect it has on us. Our genes have embedded deep inside them thousands of years of evolution. Scientific exploration of our genetic code has helped us understand our physical nature, our appetites, even our emotional responses. And we can put the idea of forgiveness into the scientific realm, too. A number of medical studies have concluded that people who forgive live longer and have healthier and happier lives. For many of us, forgiveness is a religious philosophy. It isn't based on its benefits. It requires faith and sacrifice. The rewards are mostly moral ones. But what if you could follow a religious path and experience a 27% reduction in backache or sleeplessness? What if you obeyed God's word and found a 42% decrease in depression, or a 15% reduction in long-term effects of anger? Why not have it all? Today on the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation about the art and the process of forgiveness. Our guest is Dr. Fred Luskin. He's the director and co-founder of the Forgiveness Project at Stanford University. He's also a senior consultant in health promotion at Stanford. His books include Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness, and Forgive for Love, The Missing Ingredient for a Healthy and Lasting Relationship. Dr. Luskin is in Utah today, speaking on the campus of the University of Utah. We'll give you details on that as we go along. Dr. Luskin jumped right into the conversation, saying the argument Doug laid out in the introduction is part of what drew him to studying forgiveness.
I did like your introduction teaser a little bit, if you don't mind that I just comment on that really briefly.
Not at all. Go ahead.
It was very interesting the way you presented you know, you could have it all,
right?
Almost, you know, you could have faith and connection and spirit, and also get good health.
Yeah.
And is it
true?
I have to say, at some inchoate level, that was what drew me to this field.
Hmm.
That I don't know how to articulate this exactly, but my hope was that there was a physical, material benefit to the spiritual qualities.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the spiritual dogma, but the qualities of, say, kindness and patience and compassion and forgiveness. And that was what informed my bottom line interest in this field.
Well, you write in the book that you sort of came to this study, or at least the examination of this, I suppose in some ways through a personal experience. You had been... I'm not sure how to say it. I guess abandoned in some ways by a good friend.
Oh, yeah. And I used to talk to audiences for a long time, like, kiddingly, those who can't teach. You know, so,
right.
So here I am up in front of you because I can't do it.
Right.
I mean, my closest friend at the time just stopped being my friend almost on a dime, and I responded as poorly as I now see people respond. I got angry and very upset, and lost a lot of faith and trust in my own ability to handle life and in the goodness of people. And it took me years to overcome that.
Now, at the time you were going through that sort of personal issue with your friend, were you still interested in forgiveness? I mean, had you been studying it at the time?
No. It was, I actually got interested in this because I couldn't forgive.
Yeah, because of that experience.
And it just, it opened my eyes. And I have to say, what became really painfully clear to me was this was not an isolated incident, that I had this tendency to react with anger when people disobeyed me. And the disobeyment could have been, you know, you're supposed to be my friend as long as I want you to be my friend. Or, you know, you're supposed to love me in the way that I want you to love me. And all the kind of expectations and demands that I put on other people, when they didn't meet them, I saw how quickly, maybe not even quickly, but how poorly I handled that.
So were you sort of your own little experiment into how to cope with and deal with forgiveness?
It started that way, yeah, and then it mushroomed into this almost thing that's beyond my understanding of how much I grasped of how to do it through my own suffering. When I'll tell you exactly, I can give you the moment when forgiveness flashed into my mind, was I had written a letter to this person and gotten back a response that was way below my standards. Let's just put it that way, you know? And I saw myself almost, like I saw my blood pressure rising as I read the letter. And I saw the words coming back into my mind, insensitive, inconsiderate, unkind, you know, all of the labels that I had placed on him for years. And there was a point inside of me where I said, I do not want to suffer like this again just because he's not what I think is okay.
Yeah. Okay,
and at that moment, a switch went off, and I said, wow, then you have to stop, not him.
So, Dr. Luskin, so what's going on now physically as you are, as you're dealing with this in the universal sense? What happens
to anybody who has this kind of anger, bitter, frustrated, kind of negative reaction to something?
Exactly.
Well, you know, the easiest way to make sense of it is to realize that a grievance is a repetitive experience of stress.
Yeah.
That, like, if there's someone in your life that you haven't healed with, say, it could be your mother-in-law, it could be a boss at work, it could be grandma, it could be anybody who has, in your mind, done you wrong, and you're still playing the tape again.
Yeah.
Each time that tape is played, it's an opportunity for the stress response to occur in the body, even if you haven't had a conversation with that person for years, or even if that person is dead, or even if they know nothing about what you're upset about. The hormonal and biochemical changes just cascade, and they center upon the nervous system and the cardiovascular system and the immune system. And the bottom line is, all of those changes are to prepare our bodies to fight danger. And unfortunately, when it's just a remembrance of a friend or a cruel parent, there's no real danger to fight, and it wears out parts of the body, and it strains the coping mechanisms, and it causes the body to think that being upset is normal. I mean, that's the biggest damage to it. It's almost like if you have a certain response. Let's say every time I thought of this person, my blood pressure would rise.
Right.
By the 20th time I thought of this person, I wouldn't even notice that my blood pressure is risen or think there's anything unusual about it. Well, then when I generalize that to someone else because I have created this habit, I could develop, you know, one aspect of high blood pressure simply by this constant re-examination of a stress. And that's going on all sorts of body systems. One example that people always find a little shocking is there is kind of enough research now that whenever one gets angry, one of the things that happens is the metabolism in the body changes.
Yeah.
And one of the byproducts of that metabolism is that more fat is converted, and one of the byproducts of that is the liver produces more cholesterol. Now, this is all so that that cholesterol can go into your coronary arteries so that if you're in any real danger, you'll be less likely to bleed to death. But it's certainly not highly necessary if, you know, what you're fighting is a memory of how bad your mom was. You don't need to have your coronary arteries stickied.
Yeah.
And that's just one example of the kind of changes that occurs every single time we confront something that's in our past that we haven't resolved.
And so when we release that and allow our bodies to decrease that stress level, then everything sort of levels out. We get better.
After time, yeah. In fact, I did a study with some other people at a hospital in Florida where we looked at people who had high blood pressure and taught them a forgiveness intervention. And the people who had high blood pressure and were angry, they reduced both their anger and their blood pressure by learning forgiveness. Those who were not particularly angry but had high blood pressure, the forgiveness intervention didn't change it. So for certain people, the lack of forgiveness causes longer-term damage to certain parts of the body, but it's not so in everybody.
Dr. Liskin, I wonder, do you define forgiveness any differently than a priest or a rabbi might?
You know, right now I have a glib definition of forgiveness that I teach with, and it's very helpful. I'll give you that one, and then I'll go into a more complex definition. The glib definition is making peace when you didn't get what you want.
Yeah.
And the almost the implications of that are very profound in the sense that one of the central life skills we all need to develop is learning how to deal with the word no. That no, you can't get the love you want. No, you can't get the parenting you want. No, you can't get the fairness in business you want. No, you can't get... But it goes down to as simple a thing as, no, you can't get the level of traffic you want. That what I define forgiveness now is when a wish or a desire of ours is blocked, how do we handle it? And with how much maturity? And since life is a constant experience of things not working out the way we had hoped, at some point we need to develop these skills. And I define forgiveness now as learning to make peace when something even really important didn't turn out the way you want. The little deeper definition of that, which is not that different, is that forgiveness is the experience of peace. It's just a peacefulness that comes when each of us takes something that happened to us less personally, stops blaming that experience for how we feel in the present, and starts talking about ourselves in relation to the event as if we are a hero rather than a victim. But our definition is almost entirely behavioral because we try to teach to that definition those three aspects of it.
Well, so do you think about it differently than someone who has maybe a religious perspective? Do you look at forgiveness in a different way?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't think so, but I may look at the mechanisms differently. Like, I have had many people of a diversity of religious faiths, many ministers, priests, rabbis, come and take my trainings because they feel that their religious training has pointed them towards forgiveness but never filled out the steps of how to do it. I'm more interested in the steps of how to do it, and the inner experience of someone who has forgiven is my goal, not necessarily any specific methodology of how to get there. I don't have any commitment. So let me give you an example. The core to my way of looking at forgiveness is every time something reminds one of us of what happened to us, so every time I would get reminded of my friend's cruelty, my stomach would get upset and my heart would race, and I would start that familiar pattern of feeling awful and then blaming him. I teach people stress management practices for that very second. So the very second that you start feeling upset, that's when you have to calm your mind and body down. And that you have to reclaim your power over that moment. Now, I teach it through secular means, You know, I teach people to take a few deep breaths or even picture someone they love to activate the quieting mechanism of the body. But I don't think there's anything different between teaching people to pray for them at that moment or teaching people to read biblical scripture or teaching people to do anything religious that causes that same psychophysiologic relaxation.
Dr. Fidlis,
people who have succeeded mostly tell me they learned how to do that, but there's a wide variety of ways by which they've learned how to do that.
Dr. Fred Luskin is the director of the Forgiveness Project at Stanford University and the author of the books Forgive for Good and Forgive for Love. This evening at 6:30, he'll be giving a forgiveness workshop at the University of Utah's Marriott Library. It's part of the College of Health's Integrative Health and Resiliency Conference. For tickets and more information, visit our website, radiowest.org. We have to take a brief break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm producer Elaine Clark. Today on the program, we're talking about forgiveness. Beyond being a crucial component in most of the world's religious philosophies, medical studies are showing there are health benefits to forgiving, that people who forgive live longer and have happier lives. A few years ago, Doug spoke with Dr. Frederick Luskin. He's director of Stanford University's Forgiveness Project and the author of the books Forgive for Good and Forgive for Love. He's in Utah today as a guest of the University of Utah's College of Health, so we're rebroadcasting our conversation with him. We'll give you more details on his visit as we go along.
And Dr. Luskin, we were talking about, the connections to, the secular impression we have about forgiveness and the sort of religious way we interpret the idea of forgiveness. And I wonder, as you're doing these studies, does it make sense to understand how we process the notion of religion, forgiveness in the sense of religion, as you study it, to understand it better, I guess?
Let me tell you something interesting. There was recently a study published, I think it was published, but I know I read the results of it, where a researcher used two different forgiveness interventions, one calling on religious principles to kind of compel people to forgive, and one calling on more ethical reasons for people to forgive. There were no differences in the outcome of that study. The results were the same, that there was neither an advantage for either. One of the things that I found most interesting about this whole discussion, and again, my interest is a practical one. I want to help people suffer less, and I want to help them hurt less. We did two research projects with men and women from Northern Ireland, and we took families of murder victims from both sides of that conflict. We invited first mothers who had had their sons shot in as a result of the fighting between Catholics and Protestants. And the second time, we brought 20 people who had had an immediate family member murdered, but it wasn't just a child. And one of the things we saw was how the people were trying to integrate what I was teaching them with their Christian beliefs. And it was very interesting to watch that they were translating a little bit what my more secular message through the lens of their entire life's way of looking at the world. And watching them, it seemed to amplify the effect of it. That is, the mothers in particular, even mothers from both sides of this, I mean, we brought Catholics and Protestants to sit together, and what they shared was just the gruesome death of their child, was you heard them trying to make peace of this as a response to the teachings of Jesus. And it made it much more powerful for them. When I teach this, I do it in such a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-religious audience. I mean, I'm going all over the place, that I don't have any one religious approach that would be accommodated by all. And in fact, when I have brought up any kind of religious orientation to this, if people are of different faiths, it doesn't always trigger in them an openness. That there have been some people who have said, you know, being more strict about one their faith, well, it's not true forgiveness unless it comes through Jesus. And then another person might say, you know, it would be more powerful if you use the Buddhist principles exactly. Mm. And so for my more, what would I say, work just on the practical aspects, it's been safer for me to avoid the subject.
Yeah.
On a theoretical level, I think it's a fascinating discussion topic, and then it brings up the question of, even if you don't announce it as religious or spiritual, if you act that way, is that really the essence? You know, do you need to claim anything if you become a kinder, more loving, gentler, forgiving person? And that's an open question to me.
So I suppose in some ways it doesn't really matter what motivates it as long as people feel invested in the idea.
In the idea, and I have seen so many, I don't know what the word was, transformations of people, that part of it, and I have to say this with all humility, part of it is simply like that we live in a culture where forgiveness compared to anger is undervalued. Mm. That our conversations have much more constancy relating to who pissed you off and who frustrated you, and we're very good at digging into other people's flaws, and we have many social relationships built simply on complaining about others. There is very little social discourse on simply saying, you know, the person made a mistake, or they didn't know what they were doing, or, you know, as Jesus says, forgive them, they know not what they do. We don't bring that into our conversation much. And whether it's not, to me, that has nothing to do with the religious aspect. It's that we undervalue this way of resolving conflict. What I do to a large degree is give people permission to touch that part of themselves. That, to me, being forgiving or being even compassionate is as essential a part of being a human being as is being appropriately angry and appropriately mistrustful of people. And to be a full human being, you need access to it all. And what we try to do is provide people access to missing parts of themselves. So it's not that forgiveness exists anywhere but inside of each person, and we try to teach them, A, it's there, B, you can learn how to do this, and C, here are some keys that will make this part of you more apparent.
Let's go to the phones. Olivia now joins us on the line from Bountiful. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering if you noticed any correlation between forgiving yourself as opposed to forgiving someone else and better health as well.
But we have 7 studies, and all of them were in forgiving other people. But I have to say that it was one of the things that really caught me by surprise, in that when I started to teach public classes about 3 years ago after we had done some research, in every public class someone would come up to me and said, you know, Fred, that's interesting, but my predominant problem is with forgiving myself. And it became such an apparent need, one that I hadn't anticipated, that I had to adapt some of my methods for self-forgiveness. And I now teach a whole class on that as a follow-up to the other forgiveness. And it's well-received because it's such an issue. But as all I can say is I have no data on that. I can't tell you, using numbers and randomized designs, that it's as effective. It certainly seems to be as important.
Thank you.
Olivia, thanks for the call. Joining us now on the line from Salt Lake City is Tom. Tom, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
I have a question. I've been in mental health since about 1975. And one of the things that I see, and I was wondering if the doctor found this in his study, is there are individuals who think that the world is kind of against them and that everyone's out to get them. And then on the opposite, there are individuals who believe that everyone's trying to do the best they can. And I find a significant difference between those two people. I find the first group that the mental health problem exacerbates and gets worse, and the other individuals move into a state of healing. I'm wondering if he's seen anything similar to that.
Dr. Luskin?
You know, that's a very, to me, profound kind of assessment, because asking, are there temperamental differences in people that would predispose them to taking grudges and to reacting harshly when things go wrong, as opposed to those who seem to have an ability to flow and just let life be as it is. Not only have I seen that in clinical studies, but there is evidence that people's bodies respond differently in similar directions. That is, there are some people who, whenever they're frustrated or whenever they are stymied, their entire cardiovascular system and nervous system react quickly and harshly, and they're almost overwhelmed by the physiologic input. There are other people whose cardiovascular and nervous systems react much more slowly and whose rise to upset is much gentler. And that seems to predispose those people who end up with high blood pressure or those who end up with other stress-related diseases. And it's just really interesting to see that there, it's not just situational, but temperamental.
Tom, we're glad you joined us. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You
can
join.
Ask one more thing?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I'm wondering, you know, there's been some study about the amygdala response to the vagus nerve and how that creates a real anxious process. Is he seeing a corollary with that with neurophysiology?
Well, I mean, the amygdala stores some of our emotional memories, and you want those, if those emotional memories are triggered, you really want to activate, you know, the cardiovascular system and the nervous system immediately. I mean, that's really what that's saying, and it's a protective mechanism for trauma. I mean, the thing is, if something has badly traumatized us at a time when we didn't have the resources to handle it or developmentally we weren't capable of handling it, then that does alter, is not the right word, but it changes the direction of information flow in the brain so that the amygdala may get the information a split second before the cortex, which is going to think it, because you do not want anything to trigger that kind of situation to happen again. And that is my understanding of the purpose for what you just described. However, the caveat to that is, from the majority of people, that's not the case. That in the majority of people, the information is being processed by the cortex and being thought about, and then it's going to the amygdala to be routed through other memories, and then again that activates the kind of response. It's just how unbelievably sophisticated and elaborate our body is wired to keep us safe, and it's fascinating to watch.
Thank you very much.
Tom, thanks for the call. With us is Dr. Fred Luskin. He's the author of Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness. Joining us now on the line from Salt Lake is David. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Dr. Luskin, I'm very interested in your comments about this. I've got one question about the mechanics of forgiveness, though. It seems to me that as you talk about the rise in blood pressure and how to deal with these things, you're setting out a coping mechanism, if you will. Somebody has been wronged. When that person thinks of the wrong, he gets upset. You're dealing with or teaching them how to cope with that for health purposes. My question is, how do you teach the person to actually forgive so when he thinks about the instance, the blood pressure doesn't rise? You know, I'm thinking about the... not the big things like revenge. I'm thinking more common problems. You know, a business deal goes bad.
Of course.
The many day-to-day hurts that people suffer.
Right.
They can't give up.
Right.
They can cope with them.
Right.
But can't. How can you forgive those things? How do you teach people to forgive rather than the coping mechanism?
Okay. Your comment is actually very insightful, and I would have been very happy to have that comment at one of the classes I teach, because predominantly I am looking at enhancing coping. Mm-hmm. However, I don't see that as distinct from forgiveness. That I see that forgiveness is a distinct response programmed into each human being and is one of the ways that we are designed to cope with difficulties, tragedies, losses, and things that hurt. Now, what I presented to you as managing the stress response was one of the techniques that we use to enhance coping, but it's not the entirety of forgiveness. So I'll give you a little more understanding of how we may look at this. One of the problems that people have when they get angry is one of the consequences of anger is what it does to the blood flow in the cortex, what it does to the thinking part of the brain. The previous caller talked about the amygdala and the parts of the limbic system that cause us to be aroused. When we are angry, the access to that part of our brain, the limbic system, is increased, and the access to the prefrontal cortex or the highest order thinking is decreased. Now, in an angry situation or in any response that becomes chronic, if you only have access to the part of you that gets angry, then you lose your ability to problem solve. And part of that problem solving ability may be forgiveness, but as long as anger is generated by the emotions and then by the body, you will not even be able to anticipate forgiveness. Your body won't let you go there. So you have to start by calming down. And then from calming down, your mind is free to go where it wants. Two of the other things that we teach are to investigate. It's a very simple form of therapy. It's just called cognitive restructuring or challenging. Like we challenge the, I don't know, almost the desire we have to make things wrong. And one of the things we look at is if something has already happened, to continue to argue with it as if the way you thought it should be is better than the way it actually is an exercise in futility. So another coping strategy, as you would refer to it and as would I, is to ask oneself, what am I trying to make different that I don't have the power to make different? Almost the serenity prayer. Yeah. And that's a second level of coping, but it gets us in touch with the fact that our minds are constantly trying to change things, often when we have no ability to change them, and therefore that adds a second level of helplessness and another triggering of the anger system.
It makes me wonder, though, there is that religious axiom, forgive and forget. Is forget, that the forget part of that equation, very healthy?
I think it's very unhealthy. And in fact, even with the trivial stuff you want to let go of, but for things that are of great tragedy, there's no way anybody's going to forget them anyway. And secondly, forgetting allows us to lose sight of what we have learned and how we have matured. And what you want to remember is that something painful in life happened and you coped better and that you overcame it and that you were able to go on with your life. And that is something worth remembering. But let me just add two more quick things to answer that gentleman's question. The third thing we do is we look at people stay stuck in situations because of how they talk about it. They create a story about it. And that story usually has them as kind of a victim of someone more powerful. We challenge people's use of that kind of story, and we ask them to tell different kinds of stories where they're more describing their empowerment or their goals rather than their helplessness and their victimization. Finally, the last thing we do, and this is an experiment that our caller can use or anybody can use, is just as anger limits the amount of creative thinking we can do or thinking outside of a box of frustration, whenever we contemplate something beautiful or something loving or something religious or, you know, the mountains outside of Salt Lake, whatever it is, whenever you contemplate that, you relax your mind and body in a way where thoughts of forgiveness come more readily. And we, as a last step, teach people to go not just from neutral or not just from coped, but to start filling their minds with thoughts of love and positiveness independent of the event that hurt them. And then that quietness actually gives the body access to language of forgiveness. That's a more comprehensive response to just the simple coping mechanism, but coping is critical to this process.
David, we need to take a break. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Can I make another comment?
Briefly.
But Dr. Luskin, it seems like all of your focus is on the individual here who is suffering, if you will. Isn't there a therapeutic act in approaching the person that's done the wrong, you know, again, going back to revenge on a more daily basis?
Is it advantageous
to sit down with somebody who's wronged you and say, look, I'm having trouble working through this, something like that, or is it all on the individual?
If you can talk to somebody, do it. That's a bottom line thing. However, when I looked at forgiveness and determined how I was going to work with it, forgiveness has to be independent of resolution with other people, because many of us are forgiving people who are dead, or forgiving people who don't care, or forgiving people who intended to hurt us.
Right.
And therefore, you can't let your forgiveness rest on their response.
It's up to yourself to work it out.
It gives them too much power.
Right.
What I suggest people do is, if they want to keep the relationship, or they want to, that they practice a little bit of forgiveness even before they go in to have the conversation, so that they're more open and ready to meet them rather than just dumping their grievance on somebody.
Dr. Fred Luskin is the director and co-founder of the Forgiveness Project at Stanford University. He's in Salt Lake City, speaking tonight at 6:30 at the University of Utah's Marriott Library. It's part of the College of Health's Integrative Health and Resiliency Conference, and there are details on our website, radiowest.org. We have to take another break. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm producer Elaine Clark. For many, forgiveness is a religious notion. In fact, it's a crucial part of many religious philosophies. But medical studies are giving us another angle. People who forgive live longer and have healthier and happier lives. But what do you have to let go to let go? Does forgiving have to mean forgetting? Can justice be satisfied if we apply mercy? Today on the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Dr. Fred Luskin about forgiveness. He's the author of Forgive for Good and of Forgive for Love. Doug spoke with him several years ago, but Dr. Luskin is in Utah again today. We'll give you details about his visit as we go along.
Let's go back to the phones. Liz now joins us on the line from Orem. Liz, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
I love your show. I really appreciate it. And forgiveness is huge on the top of my list. But I considered it a necessity just to get through my life or my day. Back in 91, my brother was murdered. It was a hit, and the hitman was paid $60,000 to do it. And he was just the light of my life. And I was a mad woman. I was several months pregnant with my daughter, and I would go through emotional blackouts, and it was just a horrible time. And for me, forgiveness wasn't something that I could just decide to do. As I said, I think that it was something that I had to do in order to survive. And the forgiveness came about in just for me, an amazing way. And it happened in court while the hitman was being sentenced. And I looked over and I saw the hitman's wife and father, and you know, I just realized at that point that they were going to have to do without their husband and their son in some of the same ways that I was going to have to live without my brother. And, you know, just that little bit of compassion for those people started a flood in me that has allowed me, I really think, truly to forgive. I will never forget. But in keeping with what you mentioned earlier, it's not something that, you know, not only that I could forget, but it's also not something that I don't expect anything from the man who hired the hitman or the hitman. It's just a piece that's happened inside of me, and it's been, you know, one of the most important things that ever happened.
Dr. Luskin, is this sounding familiar, and is that the idea of compassion, the kind of compassion that Liz extended to the family of the person who did the damage to her, is that an important component in all of this?
You know, every now and then when I'm on the radio, I'm struck by people whose human decency is just overwhelming, and that's the same thing I heard, you know, when I'm listening to Liz tell her story. I don't know how to describe it. It's just a wonderful thing that this reaction is in our world. Compassion towards the person who hurt is, research shows, is helpful towards forgiveness. anecdotally, when people tell you to feel compassion for someone who hurts you, it often interferes with forgiveness. And I'm not trying to. I mean, Liz's sounds wonderful, and I'm a little humbled by it. But what I have suggested to people is, if their hearts are just so harsh and so bitter, that they at least look for a little compassion for themselves to soften the horror. That it's very, very hard to be hurt, devastatingly hurt, something like this, where somebody kills someone precious to you, and at least soften with the compassion of how difficult it is to be in life with this loss, as opposed to just the rage and the resentment and the bitterness that destroy lives. I would articulate what she says in terms of it's more needed for many people than just those who have suffered catastrophic losses. So many of us are still carrying childhood wounds which we inflict upon our lovers, and so many of us are still, we come home from terrible days of work and we kick the dog. I mean, there's just so much need for us to release this stuff and reopen our hearts that, you know, this is just a profound example of a situation where most of us couldn't do it. But the bottom line, peace and healing, we all need.
Liz, we're glad you shared that with us. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
With us is Dr. Fred Luskin, the author of Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness. Joining us now on the line from Evanston, Wyoming, is Carol. Carol, thanks for waiting.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Dr. Luskin.
You're welcome.
My question is a little more mundane than the previous callers. I don't have a real tragedy in my life, but I have had situations where family members or close friends have betrayed me or tried to hurt me, and my reaction has been just to excommunicate them, so to speak,
right.
Just X them out of my life. The forgiveness is part of that, I suppose, but then it reaches the point where you say, I just won't have anything to do with them.
Right.
And I wonder if that's a healthy way to resolve
it. What that is the other side of the stress response. You've all heard of the fight or flight mechanism. Most people, when they're hurt, have fight. You know, I'm going to get back at you. I'm going to hate you. But the stress response also causes flight, and that's what I hear you doing. That the feelings that get triggered or the hurt is so deep that your response to it is to avoid the situation or avoid that person. And you know, while that could be protective of you, there are some situations where if you could have more active forgiveness, you might see that there may be some part of that relationship worth salvaging, or you may see that you can learn other coping responses to being hurt. And what I try to hope people will do is not just react under the influence of stress chemicals, that you want to have as much of yourself available to think and determine the course of your life as possible, and you don't just want to give that power over to people who hurt you. And until we can cope with the inevitable pains of relationship, which are just inevitable, we don't keep enough power for ourselves. And while I can't tell you that any of those relationships are worth reclaiming, I just think it would be useful for you to practice other responses to that. So maybe, you know, sit down with yourself and quiet yourself and decide, is there one of them worth looking back into? And then can I give them a call and see how this feels? You never have to go past whatever boundary or comfort is safe for you, but you don't want other people to have that much power over you so that the same response comes up in you every time somebody hurts you. And that's our caution to people.
But is it a legitimate response in some instances where the person is just determined to damage you?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. It's good to avoid the situation then and not expose yourself to that.
You just want to know is that you have some flexibility in your responses so that you pull the best one out.
Well, thank you so much for your advice.
Carol, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Sure,
Dr. Luskin, you had said something earlier that interested me about sort of where we are culturally, I guess as a country,
mm-hmm.
as a collective in the sense of forgiving. And I wonder, is there a trend these days away from forgiveness? Take the advice that you may get from maybe some other radio counselors like Dr. Laura comes to mind, where there's maybe some indignance that people feel comfortable with, that even some would say is entirely proper. Where are we in the sense of our culture in terms of forgiveness? Are we more likely these days to forgive or not?
I don't know if we're more likely, but when I started this research project, I was completely ignored and, you know, literally begging subjects to show up. And I remember once, that the first part of this was my doctoral dissertation, and I remember once going into a class of, like, undergraduates, and I was, like, almost 40 years old, and telling them, look at this, I'm pathetic, I'm 40 years old, I'm still in school, and the only way I'm going to get out of school is if you help me by signing up for my research project. And, you know, I said, you're appropriate, I'm not, you know, and you're the right age for this. So in that time till now, that forgiveness is part of the discussion, I think is a tremendous change. That it's not just discussed in religious circles, and it's not just relegated to, well, that's the way, you know, the churches or the synagogues teach you to do this. This is a legitimate discussion among intelligent human beings, and that is a tremendous change for that. In terms of the culture, I think we have known that we are a culture that tends to get angry, and I don't know if forgiveness is going to change that. There is one interesting study looking at, you know, hostility is a significant risk factor for heart disease, and it's one of the strongest risk factors. And one study looked at people who were hostile but forgave and saw that they didn't have the same risk for heart disease as those who were hostile and didn't forgive. And I think information like this in our very health-oriented materialistic culture is helping put forgiveness on the map. How often it's chosen, I can't know that, but it's such a nascent science, and it's such a short period of time that it's come out of the religious world that I think the jury is still out on this. I know for us, Bill Clinton's experience with Monica Lewinsky changed our social profile about this. That one of the things that happened when our research first was announced was that Monica Lewinsky's dress was identified with Bill Clinton's semen on it at the moment that our research thing, and people started to call us to say, well, really, should Hillary forgive Bill? I mean, that was kind of the way they put that together.
Yeah.
But then Bill Clinton started to talk about forgiveness, and I just see a cultural openness to this in a way that I don't think existed a decade ago. And I don't know what its effect will be. You know, there's a whole cultural shift towards the spiritual. Whether that changes behavior or not, I just don't know.
We have time, I think, for maybe one more phone call. Julia joins us on the line from Nephi. Julia, thanks for waiting.
I have a question. I actually had two, but I'll make it one now. With many therapists will tell a person who has experienced child abuse or some other offensive trauma and say, you must get in touch with your anger, you must get in touch with your rage. How do you coordinate that or deal with that in terms of your philosophy of forgiveness?
I think that getting in touch with your feelings, I hesitate to tell people what to feel. I think getting in touch with your feelings is a necessary preliminary to forgiveness. That in order to forgive, you have to know what it is that you're forgiving. And part of what you're forgiving is your emotional response to what happened. So you want to know what happened. You want to know the events of the abuse as best you can. You want to know the damage done to you, and you want to have experienced your emotional range. Before that, forgiveness is not appropriate.
Julia, we're glad you called. Thanks very much. I think we have time for one more. From Park City, Paula joins us on the line. Paula, thanks for waiting.
Some years ago, my daughter was murdered. She was in her first year of college. She was away, out of state, and both she and her boyfriend were shot to death, and we never knew who did it. But listening to your show this morning, I wondered if I was practicing forgiveness without realizing it. Since we didn't have anyone to focus on, that person was never caught. We never knew why or what. Some weeks after her death, I was burning myself up with rage. I could tell it. I would just sitting still, I would be in a sweat, just bathed in it. And when this happened, after this happened a number of times, I suddenly had this eureka moment in which I thought, if I continue to do this, if I could continue to focus on this person, I will allow him to destroy more in this family. And I decided, and I jumped up and I just did some physical exercise, and I did that every day until I was exhausted. And some of that hatred and steam and rage and grief was burned out. Were burned out. And I'm in good shape. I'm in very good shape. And
Paula, we're running out of time, so let me just put your comment to Dr. Luskin for a final response in about the minute or so we have left. Dr. Luskin?
She did a very courageous thing. She looked at her own life and saw that how she lived her life was going to determine more of the quality of it and maybe more for the memory of her slain child than just continuing to grieve, hurt, obsess, and rage just because someone had done something awful. And that is the bottom line that we teach people, that every morning, no matter what has happened to any of us, and so many painful things happen, each of us wakes up and then has some choice as to what kind of day we're going to have. And that choice should not be predicated on the worst person or the worst thing in your life. There's got to be more goodness to base that upon.
Dr. Frederick Luskin, he's co-founder of the Forgiveness Project at Stanford University and author of the books Forgive for Good and Forgive for Love. Tonight at 6:30, he's speaking as part of the University of Utah College of Health's Integrative Health and Resiliency Conference. That's on campus at the Marriott Library, and there are links to more information about tickets and other conference events at our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Video West is produced by Josh Weathers, and Radio West is produced by me and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer and host is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Elaine Clark.